Welcome to the Millionaire Next Door podcast with Robert Curtis, CFP, accredited investment fiduciary from Signature Estate and Investment Advisors. In this podcast, we help successful wealth accumulators like you looking to transition to a work optional lifestyle by helping you build strategies for growing and maintaining your wealth. Robert draws from years of experience and fiduciary responsibility and interviews guest experts to help you build reliable strategies to grow and maintain your wealth. Now, on to the show.
Okay, great. Well, good day, everyone, and welcome back to the Millionaire Next Door podcast. So pleased you're joining us, and we have another exciting episode today. We're rejoined by Will Gibson. He's a CFA, senior analyst with NASDAQ Dorsey Wright. We're going to talk a bit about the state of the markets. In some regards, I guess they feel a little odd. They've felt kind of wonky for quite some time. They kind of keep carrying on with strength. There's been about a 5% pullback since, you know, March 24 highs. But welcome, Will. Thanks for being on.
Yeah, thank you for having me back. I'm glad to make the cut again.
Oh, yeah. We appreciate it. Yeah, I follow a lot of your stuff. It's absolutely terrific. A lot of times we're trying to get into evergreen financial planning areas, things like that. But the markets and investing is still really custom investment management is the core of what we do. So delighted to have you back. And yeah, do you want to kick it off and share some of your overview of the markets, things you're seeing going on? What's standing out to you?
I would say there are some new trends developing, especially over the past couple of weeks. We'll get into these, but at a high level, you've seen an uptrend in interest rates. We've seen a short-term downtrend develop for U.S. equities. On the commodities front, that's been coming more into our headline view. Those have been ticking higher. That's kind of spurring some maybe higher for longer rate narrative. And then I think those are really the three big areas that we've talked about today. International, kind of more of the same. But I think maybe we could start with rates. That's good with you.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, rate, the higher for longer, I've just seen so much ink spilled and so much discussion about all the projected, you know, rate cuts that started off at 7. Now it's down to 2, maybe less. I kind of just stood by and watched it all, but boy, that narrative sure changed. But
yeah,
but let me get your comments.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great summary. I mean, the narrative has significantly changed, especially from the start of this year, as you alluded to. I think there was maybe 6 or 7 rate cuts expected for 2024. So far, we have yet to see one. And the expectations for those cuts continue to get punted down the road. Even some people are calling that we might not even see a rate cut this year. And then some outliers that the camp has gotten a bit more prominent is that some are even maybe we get a surprise hike. That's not consensus at this point, but just seeing where market participants are investing, that has been a really interesting and pretty big shift. And with those change in narrative, you've seen it follow through on the price action, which if you're familiar with our work, we're a technical shop. So we're not focused on fundamentals. We're really seeing how prices change, rates, of course, being a big component of that, especially in the current environment. So we've seen rates really push up across the board. We follow the US 10-year yield. That chart returned to a positive trend, which is just saying that that's a quantifiable uptrend on our system. Unfortunately for bond investors, as you know, those that are holding bonds right now, those are going down in price because of that inverse price yield relationship. Yeah. So rates go up, bond prices go down. Rates go down, bond prices go up. So that's been tough for bond investors. But I think long term, there's some good signs with rates going up. Because if you think on the contrary, why were people expecting rates to come down? That was because of an anticipated slowdown in economic activity, because rate cuts are typically seen as stimulative to the economy, right? Or accommodative right. to the economy. And at this point, it doesn't look like the market or the economy has needed that stimulative measure. So again, on the contrary, it's actually maybe a good sign that mm-hmm. we haven't had to see rate cuts just yet.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there were all these expectations, and then everybody remembers 2022. I think I read somewhere, it might have been in your work, that it was the worst bond market I was telling people historical, but I read something saying it was the worst bond market in 250 years. I didn't even know our history. You know, they're talking the Civil War. Is it any way you slice it? It's pretty bad bond year. And so, you know, we've emphasized individual bonds and shorter term, certainly over this time frame, and they've worked extremely well. Where we're getting people, maybe just shy, you know, on short term U.S. T-bills of like 5.4% state income tax free. So there's really been no reason to go long or see these big brackets around things. But the general investors who go into these sort of what I call one of five models, cookie cutter pie chart allocation, you've got, they saw big losses, you know, 10 to 14%, and they haven't recovered. And surely banks and things like that that own a lot of these long dated bonds are seeing massive losses on their balance sheet. But we've been able to very much customize that and avoid that, stick to stronger spaces, maybe floating rates, short term, you know, T-bills. And it's really been nice. Someone with $1 million can now earn, you know, 54K state tax free. That's not too bad. So it puts some of those other areas into competition. But back to your thoughts.
No, that's I'm glad to hear that you've been active in the fixed income space. If you look historically at active manager returns within the fixed income realm, they're typically better than the benchmark. People benchmark to the US Ag, which some will consider a bit of a straw man fallacy, not the most competitive benchmark to keep up with. It's typically people that issue the most debt get the biggest say in the benchmark. So it does pay to be active in the fixed income and be active in the bond market. And thinking specifically about the short end of the curve, you're right. That's been a place of relative strength on our platform for quite some time. Now that's where we've continued to suggest that our investors following our research continue to remain. And to that point, I'd be curious your thoughts on this as well. There's a higher opportunity cost now, certainly now, than there was 2 or 3 years ago. And what I mean by that is, I think I was talking about this on a recent podcast, is that when you have short-term rates where they are now 5% plus, at some point, that's going to allure people out of the equity market. People like retirees or pensions that need income to fulfill certain liabilities, they no longer have to go out into equities or the alternative market to get a certain hurdle rate of return. Now they're getting 5% on effectively risk-free. Again, positive for people that need income. You're not forced into riskier assets. But unfortunately, for maybe some long-term or longer-term equity investors, I wouldn't take this too far, but there are some headwinds there where people are getting enticed or potentially enticed out of the equity market for, again, 5% plus risk-free.
Yeah, I agree. I see it every day. Usually we have somewhat of a mix. There are probably longer or bigger growth in equities. There's certainly more risk. We've definitely got some folks that are further down the scale. Maybe they're retired or they've largely accumulated their nest egg. And let's say it's $1 million or $2 million. And they're literally like, hey, Rob, 100K a year for no risk. And I have this conversation. That makes a lot of sense. If you're good with that, why are we, maybe we wait for a dip or a better buying opportunity. It's always hard to say, but it doesn't feel like a great buying opportunity. And some of these folks are just kind of trained to always be, but sometimes I say, well, look, this, a lot has changed. You know, you're compensated very well for the past, maybe, I don't know, 17, 18 years, you weren't in this situation.
Right.
So it's worth considering. And those are discussions that we have. And some people want some of that in their portfolio or even these short term type notes. We'll get a chance to revisit it in a few months. We'll get paid well with no risk. Mm-hmm. Even if we did liquidate out of it because they're individual bonds, they're so short in what they call duration or maturity, they'd be up or down $100 or something like that in the meantime. So there's not a big principal risk. So it's actually been really great because I tend to work with a lot of savers, sort of, as I mentioned, the millionaire next door, this overnight 25-year success story. I did grow up back when, you know, I remember as like a really young kid, people who could get 6%, 10% on CDs, you know, you could grow your wealth pretty fast. So in some ways we're seeing that as a really good opportunity. And then we're trying to keep people balanced too. And in equities, in very high quality, high caliber things where it makes sense. And, you know, your system where you look at things that aren't really cutting the grade, especially in a challenging market, we have them out of there, really just the longer term type things. But it's an interesting environment. And it, I guess if people are wondering why they're working with me to get these short term T-bills, but that's just part of the equation. And that's the advice. And we're always looking at what's going on in the playing field. And, you know, we are looking to reduce risk wherever we can, because it's real capital. And especially if we can get a good return. So I'm seeing it every day. I'm buying a lot of these things. That is extremely sleep well at night type savings. So
it is.
That's cool with me. Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. I think people so oftentimes get greedy when investing, whether it's equity bonds or their portfolio as a whole. They just get concerned about the account value itself going up and hopefully more than some vague benchmark, but they forget that they're investing for specific purposes. So like you said, funding a certain lifestyle or funding certain obligations. If you can get that with lower risk, then so be it. No need to force yourself out onto the risk spectrum just for hopes of growing an account value for no reason at the end of the day. So yeah, no, that makes sense. If investors can get their goals accomplished with less risk, that makes a lot of sense. And fortunately, I would say on a positive front, the recent rate trend has helped that story. Of course, again, if you're holding them, bonds a bit of short-term pain, but overall, I think actually a good sign for maybe the economy again, short-term. There's of course some big caveats to be thrown here, but rates going higher, I think over positive. And back to a point on equities, and we can maybe move into equities after this, because rates, equities, commodities, I think they're all intertwined, always have been. And especially right now, they seem to be prominently intertwined with the high opportunity cost of the interest rate market and bonds. That is helping with, I think, some overcrowding, because there were endless posts about the Mag 7, everybody crowding into large cap growth because that was the only thing that was working. Yeah. So maybe, again, this is kind of just thoughts now, more anecdotal. I think there is some positive there as well.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, go ahead and transition to equities. People always want to hear about it. I want to hear about it. It's fascinating. And a lot is changing. You know, it had been so narrow and so dominated by these Magnificent Seven and large, you know, then we'd love to see the breadth broaden out. That isn't fully occurring, but give us your thoughts and observations. And what are you seeing?
What's happening? Yeah. Yeah. So in short, right now, our technical indicators are still bullish on U.S. equities for intermediate to long term. The recent pullback that we've seen in the market has not materially changed any of those views. So I do want to put that out there first. Long term, still constructive. Most stocks are still in positive trends, despite what the headlines are going to tell you. For instance, we track how many stocks in the S&P 500 are on point figure positive trends. That's still at 70% right now. So long-term participation is still high for U.S. equities, which is what you want to see, especially as an active investor. On the shorter end, and this is where I spend maybe a bit more of the time in terms of current updates, with the pullback, with the 5% or so we've seen, at least large cap U.S. equity, we have seen some short-term readings decline. So stocks above their 50-day moving average, which is a pretty traditional technical measurement of uptrend or downtrend, only 30% of names in the S&P 500 are currently above their 50-day moving average, which is one of the lowest readings that we've seen. In fact, that's the lowest reading we've seen since November of 2023. So that is showing some near-term, call it stress, in the market. But overall, this appears to be a pretty healthy, a pretty routine, I would go even further to say a long overdue exhale that the market's needed. I've said it in a metaphor like this before, and I'm sure you have plenty as well. But if you're watching a swimmer swim laps or race in a pool, call it the Olympics, you really don't want to see that swimmer not take a breath for too long, right? Because then we get concerned. Similar thing with equities. You want to see the markets take a breather, going straight up in a column of X's on our charts, or just straight up into the stratosphere. It doesn't really make people feel that comfortable. And yes, the best investing is typically not the most comfortable thing to do. But historically speaking, pullbacks are a good sign for markets, and high level, that's what we're seeing right now.
That's great. Yeah, that's super. It's funny, I'm a swimmer. And I swim laps almost every day. And I do try and pace myself. And sometimes I practice my breath holds. But yeah, there's payback period too. So yeah, I agree with you to have a little bit of a pullback, or where the things are more normal. for entry points feels more healthy, because a lot of times where we have new dollars coming in, and then, you know, what do you do on these allocations? The patients, that's part of the discipline and the process. The discipline is really key. And then we have other people taking distributions for one thing or another. So when we're at highs, we, you know, sometimes that's a good time to take those distributions, even if taxes are owed. But yeah,
sense.
I'd love to see the breadth widen out, but it has been an amazing market. And then we just figuratively, and I guess this emphasizes why you want these objective, unemotional, rules-based process. We haven't felt that great about things going forward. There was a lot of challenges, yet the market just keeps staying strong with a very slight pullback. So it is what it is. So that's partly what led me into why I called it pretty interesting. And it's been that way for a while, but a lot of government stimulus out there. I know that. So perhaps that wanes over time. Time will tell.
Back to your point on participation, when people talk about the U.S. equity market, they typically just default to the S&P 500, which is actually a relatively narrow group of stocks when you consider the vast universe that is U.S. equities. So if you look broader and smaller, like small caps, and equal-weighted funds like the equal-weighted S&P 500, a lot of people aren't even familiar with what that is.
Yeah.
But now that is where we haven't seen as constructive of action recently. So when you speak about participation, large cap U.S. equities, yeah, still pretty much there. Cap-weighted assets is still there. The equal-weight and smaller caps, we haven't seen as constructive action. As a result, we're kind of sticking with the large cap U.S. equity space. So for instance, the small cap, like the Russell 2000, recently that has pulled back materially and back under some multi-year highs. So that's kind of remaining in the trading range that it's been in for going on 2 years now. The equal weight S&P 500, of course, also pulled back. That is still looking somewhat healthy, but that now that's also below its prior all-time highs. So we haven't seen as strong of demand or as strong of participation in the smaller sized areas of the market, which you really do want to see for those long-term, you know, multi-year bull markets. That's typically a sign of health. Haven't necessarily seen that for now. I think on the small cap front, again, we're a technical shop, but we kind of read and get input from other areas. The NASDAQ chief U.S. economist, his name's Michael Normile, he recently put out a note to us and some of our clients talking about how small caps can kind of struggle when rates go higher. And we've seen this really play out nicely this year. Rates go up, small caps are typically pulling back the most. And he was attributing part of that is that a lot of small cap companies have floating rate debt, which means that their cost of borrowing goes up when interest rates go up. He pinned it at about a third of small cap companies. So Russell 2000. About a third of those names have a large allocation to floating rate debt. So that is maybe kind of fundamental reason why small caps tend to struggle a bit with rates going up. And that's a dynamic that we've seen play out this year. So in summary, we're sticking to that large cap U.S. equity space. Would love to see small and equal weight breakout. Hasn't happened yet. When it does, trends will be there. The process will give us signs to be in the space. But at this point, it just hasn't materialized. Last parting shot on U.S. equities, I'd say, is another headline I want to address is that a lot of funds broke below their 50-day moving average. And I'm sure the media outlets were all over this. So for example, the S&P 500 SPY ETF was above its 50-day moving average for 110 days, which is significant. That's not a very rare occurrence. The Qs, QQQ, was above its 50-day for 103 days. MTUM, a pretty popular momentum ETF, that was above its 50-day for 111 days. So all these major equity funds were above their 50-day moving average, which is just that technical definition of a long-term uptrend. For such an extended amount of time and over the past couple of weeks, they broke below those 50-day moving averages, coinciding with the recent weakness that we've seen in the market. Going from there, so we ran a study on this, going from those times that the major funds broke below their 50-day, markets typically did just fine 6 months, 1 year out, more often than not positive. I mean, SPY, Qs, and MTUM were positive at least 75% of the time. However, you did see some drawdowns of at least in the neighborhood of 8% or so over the next 6 months. So I think for your clients and our investors, that signals that I think some better buying opportunities will become available as they have in the past few days too.
Oh, good. Well, we're always on the watch out, but yeah, that's good to know. And that longer term, this doesn't necessarily mean the beginning of the end, but you're looking at that data. So that's good to know. And your point on the small caps, I mean, is really these, they're paying higher amounts. That's a steeper hill to climb. We might overlay some fundamental factors, very low to no debt. What about a company who has no debt? So it just doesn't matter. That's going to be a big advantage. But yeah, what thanks for that summary on the equities. And I, where'd you want to go next? Maybe commodities you were thinking, or what were you thinking about chatting about? Yeah.
I can briefly mention a few things that we're seeing in the commodity space. This
Yeah.
is, I think, closely tied to the rate environment as well. We've seen commodities pick up a lot of strength recently, so
Yeah.
really an uptrend for really all three areas that we've talked about today. You've seen energy do particularly well, especially crude oil has been performing well so far this year. A lot of people might not know, but XLE, so that's the major, 11 spider fund energy equity fund, that was the best performing fund in the first quarter of the year. I think a lot of people would have guessed tech, consumer discretionary. No, it was energy was the best performing fund in Q1. I talked about crude oil has been doing well. That's a big portion of it. Natural gas has not been performing as well as crude oil. In fact, there's a historic divergence between the two. I won't go into it, but we recently wrote a piece about the divergence between crude oil and natural gas. Some other areas that we've seen strength in commodities, it's really been broad-based. Copper has been moving higher, which is a good sign for the global economy. That's a very core metal. It's a base metal. It's used in tons of production. So I think that, again, kind of a good sign for the economy. And if you actually look at equity returns, when copper is performing well, historically markets have done better. Gold, of course, has been in the limelight with its advance to all-time highs. That's kind of been consolidating at current levels. I think some of the narrative for gold may be that maybe we do get some rate softening and then inflation stays a bit stickier. I think that could be the bull case for gold here. And then must not forget agriculture. They've been screaming higher this year. Cocoa has been stealing a bunch of
Yeah.
headlines. DBA is a big, broad agriculture fund. Cocoa, I think, is almost 30% exposure of that fund now, which is a really large allocation. So people are trying to get exposure. We've seen a lot of demand come online there at a higher level. So not just the individual commodity movements, but at a higher level. And this kind of fed into our original discussion about rates. When you're seeing commodities move higher, input costs as a result could raise, which could keep inflation stickier, which could maybe prevent rate cuts, keep rates higher for longer. In fact, maybe that outlier occurrence happens where you actually get a rate hike. So it's this really delicate balance because you want to see demand for commodities. You want to see them going up in price, but you don't want to see them going too much up in price
Yeah.
because then maybe you run the risk of raising rates, blowing up some more regional banks, hurting valuations for equities and companies, and being too restrictive. So it's a really delicate line to watch, but I think the hopes for a soft landing. Commodities, equities, interest rates are all intertwined right now for a lot of those reasons.
Yeah, I've always been really careful in that space because it can be very volatile. We'll
Yes.
have a fair amount of energy exposure. A lot of clients in Texas, they're very
Yep.
integrated into oil
Absolutely.
and what's going on. We've had good exposure to some of the copper producers. We just actually are getting quotes on solar right now for our, we need a new roof. And so we're looking at solar and there's, but man, it is shocking how much it costs to re-roof and get solar. But all these products going into these things, they need to be mined. You're not going to start a new company tomorrow. It's just really interesting what's going on. And I, what did I read about? Might have come out of some of your work, but you mentioned cocoa. It actually, this came right after, say, Easter. Cocoa had jumped so much, it was blowing away the return of Nvidia. And this was sort of right on the heels of everybody buying their Easter candy. I don't know if you remember that, but a couple of
I do,
clients.
yeah.
Yeah, that was wild. And it's so interesting to watch. I heard an interesting one the other day. I just follow because you guys cover it a lot, and I think it gives you a lot of thoughts. There's obviously a lot of geopolitical stuff going on too, right? That has a pretty dramatic impact on, or can. on commodities. But interestingly, I was shout out to a couple of pod. I listen to a lot of nerdy stuff on science and whatnot. There's one Huberman Lab podcast. He's a neurologist out of or neurobiology out of Stanford. And this guy, Matthew Walker, he talks about sleep. They were commenting on how caffeine is the most used drug in the world. They said it's definitely a drug. 90% of the world uses it. I'm a user, healthy cup of coffee in the morning. But they both concurred. They went on and they said, in fact, and I never heard this, they said caffeine, and I don't know if they're talking about coffee, they said behind oil is either the number two or three most traded commodity in the world. I never really thought about it, but that's where I got the info. So,
wow.
You know, a lot of times we watch what's going on under the surface with these movements, you know, even within commodities or equities, and that gives us a lot of clues as to where the puck is moving, right? So
absolutely.
I take it. Yeah. Interesting. What else are you seeing? Any other big thoughts on any other topics, or we covered a lot of it here. We have covered a lot, but
yep. Yeah, I think high level, that's a good takeaway for all of us. I would say in summary is that, again, signs of demand are good for commodities, but to reiterate, too much demand could stoke inflation, catalyze some further rate hikes, risking the potential of the recession that people have been expecting to happen for years now, and it hasn't happened. So I think that's kind of the capsule on commodities. Of course, the Fed looks at typically data that excludes the volatile food and energy prices. So maybe a lot of this doesn't directly trickle into their decision making, but it does affect investor sentiment and it doesn't affect consumer behavior. So in an unorthodox way, I think there is an important tie between what commodities are doing, what interest rates might do, and then what equities, how they might respond.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all pretty interrelated, really, right? In the whole environment of everything that's going on here. So, man, super helpful. Curious if are there any books you're reading right now that you're really into or recommend? Just thought
yeah.
I'd throw that out there.
Uh-huh. glad you asked. You actually caught me in between books, but uh-huh. A couple are on the way. One is called The Pitfalls of Speculation by Thomas Gibson. No, uh-huh. Thomas and I are not related whatsoever.
No.
It's an early 20th century work that reviews thousands of financial records and speculative trading accounts over a 10-year period. And the idea is that history kind of repeats itself or does repeat, often rhymes, the quote goes, especially with investor behavior, people being speculative with their investment accounts and what that looks like, what leads to speculation. So that's one. And then an older work that I'm starting to read as well, I'm going to butcher the name, it's like Confusion de Confusiones. I think it's French. Supposedly written in the 1600s by Joseph de la Vega about the Amsterdam Stock Exchange business. It's not a descriptive account of the process of stock trading, but he presents the history of speculation in stocks, and the dialogue allowed the reader to understand the respective perspectives of the various market participants in the 1600s about how they were viewing buying and selling a lot of commodities at the time. So it was just interesting to see that with both of these books, the thread is that people really don't change that much over hundreds of years, how they react to price changes, how they react to information as it comes to markets. And they're prone to make the same mistakes they've made for hundreds, if not thousands of years. So it's great to be able to kind of see those signs and how it's played out historically.
Wow. Okay. That's interesting. Yeah. It's really interesting when you look at stuff in the 1600s and you find parallels to today, you know,
right.
Or some of the behavior, how people are wired or whatnot. So
certainly.
And this is great having you on. That's what we try and be, is a lot of the sort of noise canceling headphones for folks and letting them know the difference between the noise and the real true signals. And so we're watching, and I utilize your systems that help a lot to just see what's really changing or staying the same, or what's strong and what isn't. So a lot of great points, Will. Really appreciate you coming on. I'd love to have you as kind of a regular sidekick to go over this stuff. It's super helpful. So, yeah.
I'd be honored.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Yeah. Any other parting thoughts or closing, or should we just land the plane here and invite folks back for the next episode?
Let's do that. I've
okay.
Rambled long enough. So thank you
yeah.
again for having me. Appreciate it.
Perfect. Sounds great. Everyone, make it a great day. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you for listening to the Millionaire Next Door podcast. Click the subscribe button below to be notified when new episodes become available.
The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Signature Estate and Investment Advisors. Signature Estate and Investment Advisors, LLC, SEIA, is an SEC-registered investment advisor. However, such registration does not imply a certain level of skill or training, and no inference to the contrary should be made. Securities offered through Signature Estate Securities, LLC, member FINRA SIPC. Investment advisory services offered through SEIA, LLC, 2121 Avenue of the Stars, Suite 1600, Los Angeles, California, 90067. Telephone number 310-712-2323.